This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The opening ceremonies for Torino 2006 are just 13 days away. Here to discuss the impending 20th Winter Games is John Powers of the Boston Globe. John, welcome back.
Thank you, Bill.
Yesterday, skater Michelle Kwan ran through her short program and a free skate for a five-member committee so that committee could determine whether she was fit and whether she would remain on the U.S. squad for next month's games. She's in, at least for now. Do you have any idea what the committee saw that convinced them that Kwan is skating at the so-called competition level?
Well, I think even though it's supposed to be judged on what Kwan can do now, everyone there knew that she doesn't have to skate until February 21st, so that gives her three more weeks to get ready, to get her programs in shape, and I think the feeling was she's good enough right now.
Does Kwan's inclusion increase the medal chances for the U.S.?
Probably not. If you look at last year's World Championship, Kwan finished fourth. It was the first time she hadn't won a medal at the world level in about a decade. Sasha Cohen, who has won silver at the last two Worlds, is probably going to be the best U.S. hope, and given the international levels these days, two American medals for women are probably doubtful.
This business of a closed-door session with judges only and maybe a few family members watching someone skate, it seems unprecedented to me. Are you aware of anything like this before?
Well, actually, any time that this has happened before, with Todd Eldridge, for example, in 92, Nancy Kerrigan in 94, they were monitored by judges, sometimes only one judge, just to kind of get that sense of fitness. What's actually unusual is that a skater had to do a short and a long program at a competitive level in the same day, and that's what Kwan had to do. So by figure skating standards, this is very demanding. But I think the feeling was if you let spectators in, it would be a circus a la 1994 when Nancy and Tanya went head-to-head on the ice for the first time in practice.
In a Rolling Stone interview this week, Bodie Miller reinserted his ski boot firmly into his mouth when he accused Barry Bonds and Lance Armstrong of, quote, knowingly cheating. There is some evidence that the U.S. ski team officials are beginning to get a little weary of Miller's act, don't you think?
I believe so. Especially, it would be one thing if Bodie had been having a fantastic winter, but he is not. As a matter of fact, Darren Rawls, if anybody now, has a better chance to win gold there. I think what you're seeing, though, is the new Olympian as entertainer. It doesn't matter what you do at the games. It is what you say before and during that counts.
On Thursday, U.S. ski team Alpine director Jesse Hunt predicted 8 medals for the U.S. team. Is this realistic or just an example of kind of pre-Olympic bravado?
I think it's realistic if you throw in the snowboarders. I think that if everything hits right, it's possible. But don't forget, the U.S. historically has not done all that well outside of the U.S. And last time in Salt Lake, the only two medals by the Alpine people were won by Bodie Miller. It's a little deeper team. They've had some people on the podiums, but I think 8 is probably excessive. But if you want to include half pipe, then you're there.
Seems to me that the danger is if you start making predictions and you fall short, then everybody comes away disappointed, even though there have been some terrific performances.
That's true. Well, I think that's why the USOC, which kind of brashly said that they would win about 100 in Athens and did win that, are pretty much backing off of that. I know they had talked about, they had won over 30 last time in Salt Lake, which was highly unusual. They really aren't talking much now about it, but I think privately, if they can win 25, they would be delighted with that, but they will never say that now.
One of the neat things about the Winter Olympics, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that every once in a while a really offbeat story bobbles up, like the Jamaican bobsled team in 1988 or the British ski jumper Eddie the Eagle. Any chance we get something along those lines in Torino?
It's much more difficult now because of the Eddie the Eagle and the Eric De Eel, who was the swimmer who almost drowned at the Olympics, they make them qualify. For example, the big story so far had been there is a skeleton sledder from Iraq who is trying to make it.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is you just can't show up anymore. One thing that they have learned is in the Winter Games, you can die. You can die in the downhill. You can die in the bobsled. So just for safety issues, it's much less likely.
John, we have heard some people who have seen Torino and Sestriere say that these venues are not as prepared as they might be. Have you heard anything to that effect?
Well, we have been hearing things that they aren't quite ready for the big party to start. It's And I think what it may have surprised the Italians is that people actually show up a couple of weeks before the games start. It's like something showing up for Thanksgiving dinner on Wednesday night. I think certainly a lot of the phone things aren't ready yet. Some of the banners aren't up. Some of the rooms aren't quite ready. I know there was going to be more of a problem in the mountains because the accommodations there aren't used to the major Olympic deluge. But the Italians have said when we light the candle, all will be ready. I remember going to the World Swimming Championships in 94 in Rome, and the day it was starting, didn't have any of the phones or any of the computers hooked up, but the press bar was up and running beautifully.
So there were no complaints.
No complaints from us.
John Powers is the Boston Globe's Olympic correspondent. He joins Only a Game from time to time to share his expertise. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.
In Australian Open action yesterday, Amélie Mauresmo, the tournament's number 3 seed, won her first slam title by beating the number 8 seed, Justine Henin-Ardenne. Mauresmo won the first set 6-2, and then down 2-love in the second set, Henin-Ardenne retired with stomach pain. Amélie Mauresmo had won her semifinal match when Kim Clijsters turned her ankle and could not continue. The women's doubles saw Yan Zi and Zhang Ji become the first Chinese players to win a Grand Slam title. They defeated Lisa Raymond and Samantha Stosser 2-6, 7-6, 6-3. But perhaps the tournament's greatest surprise was the arrival in the men's final of Marcos Bagdatis, who upset David Nalbandian on Thursday in a semifinal. Bagdatis, unseeded in the tournament, will face the world's number one player, Roger Federer, for the title. Following this year's Australian Open, the ATP Tour will continue with 9 months of international tournaments, most notably in Paris, London, and New York. Along for the ride will be a cadre of highly strung pros who don't command the same fame or fortunes as the Federers, Davenports, Roddicks, and Clijsters of the tennis world. Only a Game's Ron Schachter reports.
During the U.S. Open in New York last September, there was plenty of skill, precision, and concentration evident on almost every court. The same qualities were at work underneath Arthur Ashe Stadium, where a different set of professionals toiled under the fluorescent light, far from the limelight.
Okay, I think something wrong here, right here, yes.
At 8 stations in a windowless room, members of an international crew were bent over computerized stringing machines, swiveling vices that held the tennis rackets and weaving in new strings. The only decorations on the cinder block walls were temporary signs, like the one which read, Jay's Custom Stringing. Jay Schweid, who started stringing rackets in his Queen's living room 25 years ago, made it to the French Open when he was 18.
I'd done some local tournaments. There used to be a tournament called the WCT in Forest Hills, so I'd met some players there. I just figured, you know, I have nothing to lose. I'll go to Paris and I'll see if those people remember me and set up in a hotel room and see what happens.
What happened was a career in stringing tennis rackets for tennis stars from Martina Navratilova and John McEnroe to Andre Agassi and Andy Roddick. Tim Strawn has strung at Wimbledon for 6 years and runs Grand Slam Stringers in Roanoke, Virginia. He sums up the requirements for stringing rackets at the elite level.
Perfection. In one word, when you work at that level and you have players on the court who have literally hundreds of thousands of dollars resting on their racket, you have to do your work at the highest level possible so that nothing goes out of the door with any mistakes.
When do you play?
We're second after 11. Well, yeah, so 12. For, is 11:30 all right?
It's going to be a little tight.
At the U.S. Open, Schweid's team finished almost 3,000 rackets at $25 apiece over the 3 weeks of qualifying and tournament play. A touring pro will bring anywhere from 3 to 12 freshly strung rackets to a match. Those rackets may be strung at the same tension, which can slacken over the course of a few games, or they can be set at different tensions, letting the player decide what would work best under varying conditions.
Generally, the rule of thumb is a lower string tension will help give you more power. Higher tension will give you more control.
Tom Martinez, who strings up to 40 rackets in a 20-hour shift, has been working the Open since 2000. He slices the old strings, pulls them out, and begins weaving with polyester, nylon, cattle gut, or some combination of the three. The job takes just under a half hour, although Martinez has knocked off rackets in 10 minutes for on-court emergencies. He's also offered some expert advice to players.
They'll come to us, ask us what conditions are like, what do we recommend, what are we hearing from other players. Like, let's say on a certain day, oh, it's windy, what do you think I should do? If it's humid out, you want to sometimes drop the tension because the balls feel a little bit heavier because there's more moisture in the felts and everything.
Jay Schweid recalls an even more complicated transaction with Andre Agassi.
A couple of years ago at the French Open, Andre was really struggling trying to figure out. We were trying different strings and different combinations, different tensions, and literally during the match, he had me go back to the hotel, and I had to go up to my room, obviously string as fast as I could, and had one of my assistants drive back, and we just kept going back and forth during an entire match. He won, and I was tired.
Trying to make a living as a stringer can also be expensive. Tim Strawn, who holds a day job with the local phone company and also runs a tennis pro shop, works just two or three tournaments a year.
If you don't get good airfare and you go over there to work, and depending on how many days you work and what your salary is, you might be fortunate to break even.
In order to help his fellow stringers break even, Strawn started a website where they can share information from tournaments around the world. They post travel tips, warnings about particularly difficult coaches and players, and updates on the strings the pros are choosing. Lately, Strawn says, there's been a movement from polyester to gut.
Gut is coming back, and we're all just overjoyous about that, believe it or not. Polyester is a very, very stiff material. Gut is a very soft and supple material. So when you can think about a person standing in a stringing machine, stringing anywhere from 20, 25, 30 rackets a day, when you're handling something that almost feels like like a piece of wire instead of a piece of string, it really wears on your hands.
Jay Schweid says that success as a full-time racket stringer can mean being away from home for most of the year.
You can make a decent living, but to do it right, you're going to be on the road a lot. You're not going to be able to have a family. You're not going to be able to have a life.
After 25 years on the road, Schweid is thinking about retiring. Tim Strawn will be headed back to Wimbledon in June. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. Barney Ross, boxer, soldier, messenger boy for Al Capone. But first,
come on inside.
Okay.
This right here, this is Peter Marciano, Rocky's younger brother. This is them reading the paper of Rocky winning the championship. They were just kids at the time.
They were just kids, boy.
Just sitting on the front steps right here.
The front steps to which Mark Cassiri refers lead up to the two-family house at 168 Dover Street in Brockton, Massachusetts. The paint on the door is blistered. The inside of the house is pretty beat up, too, stripped to wallboard. But the place looks a heck of a lot better than it did half a dozen years ago when a sewer line leading into it broke and the building was condemned. The improvement is largely thanks to the efforts of Mark Cassiri, who bought the house in which former heavyweight champion Rocky Marciano grew up and has dedicated himself to restoring it to its glory days when it was home to the only heavyweight champ who never lost a professional fight. In the spare small dining room of the house, Cassiri points out a photographic clue to the source of Rocky's strength.
This is Rocky with his family having dinner in this room. If you see in the background, you can see the built-in hutch, which
right
is right here.
To our right, yeah.
And if you notice, this is Peter, Rocky's youngest brother, and he's wearing a boxing glove at the table. And this here, these are his three sisters, Alice, Betty, and Connie, and that is his wife right there, Barbara. Rocky, his father, and his mother pouring Rocky milk.
I was going to say, this is a very wholesome picture. Rocky's about to get a glass of milk at the dinner table.
The one thing was, they always made sure Rocky got more than everyone else because he needed his strength.
That strength and a relentless work ethic enabled Rocky Marciano to win the heavyweight championship by knocking out Jersey Joe Walcott on September 23, 1952, and to finish his pro career 49-0 with 42 knockouts. But by 1998, the house on Dover Street was boarded up and essentially abandoned. Eventually, the city of Brockton arranged to auction it, but a former mayor and several concerned citizens managed to save the place from what would almost certainly have been demolition, and two sales later, with the help of a loan from Peter Marciano, Mark Cassiri moved in. He's been living in the second-floor apartment and painstakingly restoring the exterior and the first floor ever since. In the process, he's learned a good deal about the former champ and his family. Old photographs have enabled Kasiri to put a lot of the furniture he found in the cellar back where it was when Rocky was growing up. In the bedroom where Rocky's parents slept, there's a scarred wooden bureau upon which stands a plaster statue of St. Peter.
Mrs. Marciano had prayed to the statue of St. Peter that Rocky would recover from pneumonia, and this was at 2 years old. And this it was very serious back then. You're talking 1925. He was born in 1923. Very serious.
And the prayers were answered.
Yes, the prayers were answered. Mrs. Marciano had put her wedding ring next to the statue and said to take her wedding ring. She wants her son to recover. And the next day, that ring was gone. She never found it. And Rocky had recovered.
It would be a good story if it ended there, wouldn't it? But this is a heavyweight champ we're talking about here, so the finish is even more boffo.
And the thing was, when Rocky won the fight against Joe Lewis, he actually went out and bought a brand new ring for his mother and gave that to her to finish the story. That's as much as I've heard about it, but that's definitely the statue, and I'm holding on to that.
I back slowly away from the statue of St. Peter, and Mark joins me in the kitchen, then nods toward the back door. He says if we go down to the cellar, we can see the beam where Rocky used to hang his heavy bag for workouts.
He used to have a lot of card games down here.
Oh, yeah?
Oh.
Was that because Ma didn't like the card games upstairs?
Yeah, probably didn't agree with the gambling part of it. Here are the two spots right here.
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Nails pounded in probably 8 on this side or 8 or 10 and then more over here.
Yep. He used to hang his bags right here.
The official line is that once the restoration of the Marciano house is complete, it will become not only a tourist attraction that will make of Brockton, Massachusetts, what the public relations people call a destination point, but that it will also delight the residents of this neighborhood, many of whom were contemporaries of Rocky and his younger brothers and sisters. The problem with that theory is that in its unfinished state, 168 Dover Street has already begun to assume the latter function. Even as Mark Kasiri was leading me from room to room, some of Rocky's contemporaries began to drop in, each with his own file of Rocky stories. John Kelleher, who lives a few doors down, was among them, and he recalled how when Rocky first started fighting locally and in Providence, lots of people in the area felt the ex-baseball player, ex-shoe factory worker, and ex-soldier would soon be an ex-boxer.
It's like anything else. If you get somebody coming from your neighborhood, you tend to discount his qualities and stuff.
How can he be very good? He lived right down the street from me.
Like the blessed Lord, you know. He's growing up in a little village, and then all of a sudden he's doing miracles. So some of the local Italians and others thought that this was a flash in the pan, and they take advantage of it, so they started betting against him. Not a lot, but some, you know. So then what the heck happened? He started really taking off, you know.
Rocky Marciano took off well enough to leave behind Brockton and Providence, where he was making $40 or $50 per bout, and to earn fights in New York. He beat Joe Lewis there in 1951, then took the title from Joe Walcott in Philadelphia a little less than a year later. After 6 successful title defenses, Marciano retired in 1956. The video version of that story was running in what had been the family dining room when Charlie Tattaglia knocked at the front door. Currently a deputy state boxing commissioner and the owner of George's Restaurant in Brockton, which features about a kabillion photos of Rocky and various other boxers on the walls, Tattaglia was the bat boy for Rocky's Little League team. He was also close to Ali Colombo, who helped train and manage Rocky, so Charlie knows the Rocky stories that didn't make the video.
I guess Rocky used to stay at the Knickerbocker Hotel. One day they're leaving the Knickerbocker Hotel, and he said, "Oh, geez, you got to go upstairs." He said, "I left about $10,000 worth of bonds under the mattress," he says. You know, and another time we was supposed to, Ali told me these stories that Rocky was supposed to get like $10,000 or $5,000 to go to Toots Shore's place, and he called him up like a couple hours before the show, and he said, Rocky said, "I'll be down to do the show tonight. You got the cash to go?" He said, "No, I got a check." "Oh, no," he said, "I'll do it for half if you give me cash."
Charlie Tattaglia's take on Rocky's preference for cash is that a bad business agreement with a former manager deprived the champ of half of everything he made, even after the ex-manager had departed the premises. And Rocky knew the ex-manager would have a harder time chasing cash than checks. Tattaglia maintains that when he was flush, Marciano would help anybody in the neighborhood.
Rocky was the type of guy that if you asked him for $100, he'd give you $100. He was that type of guy. If you were down on your luck, but you know, he wanted you to pay him back.
He was also the type of guy that if the house in which he grew up falls into disrepair, a bunch of neighbors and friends and some politicians and a fellow who's handy get together and restore the place. The idea being that Rocky Marciano and his legacy are valuable and Brockton shouldn't lose them. That conviction comes in part from loyalty to neighborhood and heritage, certainly, but it also comes from the recognition that, as Charlie Tattaglia says, no other heavyweight champion has ever retired undefeated.
I remember one time I started Tenenbaum Bar in 1957, and somebody at the bar says, you know, how good is Rocky? You know what a customer said? Only time will tell. It was 50 years later. He's withstood the test of time. It's just too bad that his life ended so short, because he would be bigger. He'd be bigger than the heavyweight championship now. He'd been a monster in the sports field. He was great. Great.
Rocky Marciano died on August 31st, 1969, when the small plane in which he was traveling crashed in an Iowa cornfield. To some extent, Marciano's accomplishments have been overshadowed by the flash and dazzle generated by the exceptional career of Muhammad Ali. Now, at 168 Dover Street in Brockton, Massachusetts, the self-styled City of Champions, with the support of Marciano friends and fans like Charlie Tattaglia, Mark Casiri continues at the work of restoring the place where neighbors and visitors can remind themselves to appreciate the Rock, the local kid who never lost. Barney Ross was the first prize fighter to capture two championship belts in the same fight. Part of his apprenticeship was running errands for Al Capone. John Garfield, Jimmy Cagney, and George Raft all wanted to play him in the movies, and that's only the beginning of the story of Barney Ross, the boxer about whom Douglas Century has recently written a book. The author joins me now from New York. Douglas Century, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Great to be here.
Barney Ross was a sickly child, and his mother opposed the idea of his becoming a fighter. What accounted for his choice of profession?
Well, it's almost like something out of Charles Dickens. He's born Dov Bear Rasovsky on the Lower East Side. The family moves to Chicago when he's just a toddler. They live in the Maxwell Street ghetto, which is teeming with immigrants and poverty. And he's asthmatic and underweight. The real reason he would never have become a prize fighter, his family are Kohanim, which is the priestly caste of Judaism. His father always said, you know, let the atheists be the trumbaniks, the troublemakers. You know, we're the scholars. And he really wanted Barney to be a Hebrew teacher. The father, he's actually murdered in a holdup in 1923 when Barney's just 13 years old. And the family is just split into the youngest, Barney's two youngest brothers and youngest sister are sent to an orphanage. So it becomes like something out of Dickens. Barney is a little bit of a tough guy in the streets. And the only reason he becomes a prize fighter is he vows, I'm going to make enough money to get my kid brothers and kid sister out of the Jewish orphanage, which he eventually does.
Today, there are dozens of championship belts because there are several different associations and federations awarding championship belts. Nobody can keep track of them. But when Barney Ross fought Tony Canzonieri in 1933, the champ was the champ. How did Ross become the champ in two divisions in one night?
Well, what happened really was Tony Canzonieri had the lightweight belt and the junior welterweight belt, which wasn't as significant a belt as the welterweight. So they fought the first time in Chicago, and Barney becomes a two-time champ. It's when he steps up in weight, actually, a year later and fights the welterweight king, which was Jimmy the baby-faced assassin McLaren, that Ross actually is the welterweight, lightweight, and junior welterweight champion. And it was quite a feat. I mean, in those days, the lighter weight divisions really mattered. There weren't great heavyweights until Joe Louis came along, which was 3 or 4 years later. So that was the era when tough Tony Canzonieri was a hero to the Italians, and Jimmy McLaren was a godlike figure to the Irish. And there was Barney Ross, who was the pride of the Jewish ghettos across America.
Barney Ross joined the army in 1942, and the act was portrayed as heroic. But what was Ross's motivation at that point?
I'd always wondered about that. It seemed a little too perfect just to say, well, I was a hero. So getting to know his last surviving sibling, George Rassoff, told me, you know what, my brother was You know, he was down and he was disgusted. He'd blown all this money. He'd been this, made, you know, hundreds of thousands of Depression era dollars and blown it all. So here he was, basically in a depression. And I mean, you know, manic depression type of state. And he went off to the Marines and sent George letters that George told me he had to shred because he didn't want anybody to see them, in which he was basically saying, that's it, I'm going off, I'm going to die. By an amazing fluke, it was one of those things that just sort of defined his life. He becomes a huge hero in Guadalcanal. He saves several of his dying comrades, and basically he single-handedly kills 22 Japanese and wins the Silver Star and Purple Heart. And, you know, he comes back to the U.S., this unexpected hero, because it begins the whole second act of his life where he's almost a bigger star. He becomes an American hero rather than just a boxing hero in 1943.
While he was still in the ring, Barney Ross may have been a compulsive gambler. As you say, he certainly lost a great deal of money at the track and elsewhere. And then the injuries he suffered during the war seemed to lead to a second and, I thought, even more devastating addiction.
You know, if you do research into this, it's not that uncommon. I think that there was a spike in morphine and heroin addiction after World War II among servicemen. What basically happens is, at that point, the wounded guys on Guadalcanal end up self-medicating. They had access to their own injections, and they would just basically do it for pain. He has malaria, and was hit by shrapnel several places. So he comes back to the States, and as you said in your intro, everybody, all the movie stars want to play him in the movies, and his life is optioned. Meanwhile, he's a junkie. I mean, he's really become an addict. For a time, he's able to hide it because he goes to doctors and can beg for pain prescriptions. But fairly soon, he's really out, you know, scoring heroin in the streets, is being blackmailed because the pushers know, hey, you know, you're the ex-champ, you're a Silver Star hero. You know, President Roosevelt just honored you at the Rose Garden. You know, you can't be seen buying heroin, so they would blackmail him. It's not a long period in his life, but he finally realizes he's at the bottom of the barrel, and he at that point you had to turn yourself in for arrest. There was no rehab society like we have now. There was no Hazelden and things like that. So he actually has to go and turns himself in for arrest, and he's one of the most prominent, the first prominent Americans to publicly come out about heroin addiction. And he goes to this public health hospital, which is really kind of a jail in Kentucky, and he kicks it. And you know, to his credit, he then basically goes on a campaign for the rest of his life. He testifies before Congress, and he's very adamant that, you know, the drug addiction should be treated as a medical problem and not a criminal problem. And I think he's decades ahead of his time. If you read what he has to say about drug addiction from an addict's perspective, it's just startling. I mean, it's still the debate we're having today.
In 1967, toward the end of his life, Barney Ross was the beneficiary of several fundraisers. Otherwise, the family he left behind would have been in pretty tough shape. What accounted for the affection that so many people in the boxing community and beyond felt for him at that point?
Well, it's twofold. One is that he was an absolutely classy fighter. The combination of ring smarts and just the classy attitude he brought to the ring. Everyone remembered it. He didn't have a mean streak. Oh, Barney would be beating the hell out of his sparring partners and he'd stop in the middle of the sparring to apologize to them, and his managers would be yelling, "What do you punch him for God's sakes?" You know, he just wasn't he wasn't a mean guy. The other thing was he was the softest touch in the world. He lent money to everybody. There's just stories, little postage stamp sized stories you find in all the New York papers of him. Some old, you know, World War I veteran is being evicted for lack of rent, and Barney shows up and gives him $500 to pay the rent. People would ask, "Barney, where'd you get the money?" "Oh, I borrowed it from some guy in the meat business. You know, the guy's in trouble. You got to help." He went around helping everybody. So when he has these testimonial dinners that you speak about in 1966, he's got terminal cancer. You know, the fight community certainly recognized that this was one of the all-time greats, and more than just I think one of the sports writers said he didn't need to win a title to be a champion. I think that was Jimmy Cannon. He was a champion by virtue of his human nature. He was a mensch.
Douglas Century is the author of Barney Ross, available beginning next week from Random House. Douglas, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks, Bill. It was great being here.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a mistake of Olympian proportions. But first, joining me for a conversation about the week's news is Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The Aussie Open is going on as we speak, and I think the best stories this week were the rise and fall of Martina Hingis and the ascent of Marcos Bogdatis into the limelight. Do you agree?
Yes, Marcos Bogdatis has become a wonderful fan favorite and is now becoming cannon fodder for Roger Federer. A fan favorite who is fodder for Federer, by
Very
the way.
Very nice. Better still.
Men's tennis is on the verge of having a Pete Sampras problem in the majors, namely that Roger Federer is just a lot better than everybody, except for the annual freak show that is the French Open. So anytime somebody comes out of the pack like Bogdatis has to make a final is all for the good.
As comebacks go, can you think of a tennis player who has successfully returned to the tour after more than 3 years, 4 years off it?
No, but Martina Hingis looks very strong and has played fairly well, made the quarterfinals in a major, her first tournament back. If she can remain competitive with the younger players who have gotten more experience than she has during her sabbatical, that's all to the good, too.
So, Super Bowl tomorrow. Oh, sorry.
What?
This is one of these years where they put 2 weeks between the conference championships and the event of events. I'd forgotten. But anyway, is your anticipation level rising?
I think it is a little bit. It's going to have, like the rest of the country, it's going to take me a little while to take Seattle and Pittsburgh seriously as the competing teams. For example, if you're having a Super Bowl party and your annual tradition is to cook food representing the two cities,
mm-hmm.
What do you do? Go to Starbucks? And then, like, buy a slab of pig iron and put them both on the table?
They don't eat pig iron, even.
I thought they made bacon out of it.
In National Hockey League news, the owner of the Pittsburgh Penguins has retired, and the team's star has retired as well. It's remarkable that both should have done so on the same day, isn't it?
You suppose Mario Lemieux called himself? Hello, I'm retiring now. You better
don't do it.
No, I'm sorry, I have to.
Well, then me too.
Yeah, he now has Mario Lemieux, who is the medical chart of Dorian Gray, now has an atrial fibrillation that has to be controlled by medication. So he's retired again. He's battled through back trouble, Hodgkin's disease. Just an extraordinary player, an extraordinary person. I hope he maintains his ownership in the Penguins. I hope he's around the league because he's one of its best ambassadors.
On Sunday night, Kobe Bryant scored 81 points against the Toronto Raptors. I've always thought the place to look for points after the game was the scorebook, but apparently I was mistaken.
Because you didn't go to eBay on time the way many people do. There's a person who claims on his eBay prospectus that the actual points scored in all the NBA build up in a hole in his basement. They flow through tubes in liquid forms, and he pumps out the hole in his basement so he has all the points scored in the NBA liquefied in a jar. Now, mm-hmm. I see you're having a little trouble following this.
I'm just trying to find the website so I can buy them.
The guy last week pumped all 81 of Kobe Bryant's points out of his basement and put it in a jar, which he then held up in front of a camera, is now selling on eBay. Now, as I've often said, the United States of America is the greatest place on earth ever devised to be completely out of your freaking mind. This guy is not the guy who's completely out of his freaking mind.
No,
the guy that's bid over $1,000 for liquefied NBA points in a jar is the guy who's completely out of his freaking mind.
Charlie, I've seen lots of basketball games where fans behind the basket will wave thunder sticks or towels or something to distract opposing players at the foul line. But this week, LeBron James had to contend with a more high-tech distraction. How did he do?
He got very upset, and frankly, I would be too. Somebody brought one of those laser pointers to the game, and the idiot started focusing it in his eyes and his head and stuff like that. I would point out to anyone who's inclined to laugh this off that these are also the things that people use for sniper scopes.
Hmm.
Yell, scream, wave big old cardboard heads of Condoleezza Rice, throw up confetti, bang the thunder sticks. Laser beams is really a bit much.
The campaign to retire number 21 across all of Major League Baseball in order to honor the late Roberto Clemente encountered opposition this week from Sharon Robinson, daughter of the late Jackie Robinson. What exactly is her objection?
Well, she believes that her father's contribution to Major League Baseball and breaking the color line is greater than Clemente's contribution, which was essentially to be a hero and role model for Latin players. I really wish this hadn't become a controversy because it lends itself to some very ugly undertones among people who've already been ignored by Major League Baseball enough. I tend to agree in theory with Sharon Robinson's point. Jackie Robinson's breakthrough was far beyond anything Roberto Clemente ever did. Saying that, if baseball wants to honor a man of great dignity who died doing charitable work for earthquake victims in Central America by retiring his number, it's hard to argue with that, too. I just wish this whole thing had never come up.
Barry Bonds will not be playing for the U.S. team in the World Baseball Classic in March. He says he doesn't want to risk injury. How would playing against Canada or South Africa be more dangerous than playing against the Dodgers or the Diamondbacks?
Well, you might trip over the doorstop on your way in and out of the drug testing facility, and then you would really hurt yourself.
Remarkably, there was no announcement this week that Alex Rodriguez will play for Wales rather than Mozambique. Maybe next week.
All he has to do is take all the vowels out of Rodriguez, and he can play for Wales.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
And in my basement, I can turn lead to gold.
In less than 2 weeks, the torch will have been lit at Stadio Olimpico in Turin, or Torino, if you prefer. At last count, the Olympic Organizing Committee was facing a budget shortfall of nearly $100 million. Little more than half the tickets to the Games had been sold, and thousands of hotel rooms were still available. If history is any indicator, taxpayers in the Piedmont region of Italy have reason to be concerned. Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Okay, so we're looking at the scale model of the Olympic Park as it is right now. It's been renovated or redone for this year.
Since 1977, some 3 million people have taken this tour of Montreal's Olympic Stadium. It's one of the city's most visited sites, but no one can be sure whether the tourists come because they want to see the unique architecture of Montreal's so-called Eiffel Tower, or because they're curious about the building that put Montrealers in debt for 30 years.
When Montreal was chosen against Moscow and Los Angeles.
It wasn't supposed to be this way. In January of 1973, when Montreal announced its budget for the Games, IOC President Roger Rousseau promised the event wouldn't cost the taxpayers a penny.
The 1976 Olympic Games would be self-financing without adding in any way to the Canadian taxpayers' burden, without any special subsidy of any type whatsoever.
Montreal's mayor, Jean Drapeau, took the guarantee further, famously declaring, "The Olympic Games can no more lose money than a man can have a baby." But nothing went smoothly for Montreal's organizing committee. An oil crisis and inflation sent costs skyrocketing. A labor strike delayed construction of Olympic Park for 5 months. And engineers had trouble turning architect Roger Talibert's Olympic dreams into some sort of reality. Less than 5 months before the Games were to begin, FINA, the World Aquatics Authority, threatened to move the swimming competition to another location. Bob Dubot, deputy director of the sports division, accompanied FINA officials to the construction site.
There was no roof yet, and it just did not seem possible. And I remember the day it was way below zero, and it was cold, and we're out there in the snow, and there was cranes all over the place, and people were working. And we had a working session with the contractors and the chief engineers, and they took out their critical paths, and they indicated to us very clearly that, yes, it would be ready, and it was.
The final cost of construction delays wouldn't be known until long after the Games ended, but Montrealers knew the costs were rising. 2 months before the opening ceremonies, a new tax on tobacco was announced, and smokers in Quebec province were warned that the measure might be in effect for up to 4 years to finance the Games. All told, it would take more than 30.
I declare open the Olympic Games of 1976. Celebrating the 21st Olympiad of the modern era.
Despite the delays, the games began on time on July 17, 1976. Former Canadian Olympic Association president and IOC vice president Richard Pound says, for a moment at least, Montrealers were able to put aside the controversies and cost overruns.
At the opening ceremonies, the biggest ovation for anyone was for Jean Drapeau. This was his baby, and people were very proud of it. There were elections coming up, no question. I mean, in any democracy, you're going to have, as John Foster Dulles said, 20% of the people are against everything, all the time. So you start, you know, with percentage number 21, and I think there was a pretty strong feeling of support for it.
News of construction delays, budget deficits, and an African boycott dominated the lead-up to the Olympics. CTV Montreal sports director Ron Roush broadcast the games, and he has a more cynical view of the opening ceremonies.
Montreal supported the games, but we all knew here in this city that we were going to be paying for it for a long time, and it was just—it was almost like you were resigned to it. You know, you knew that this was going to be very, very costly. You better enjoy it because we're not going to be enjoying the next couple of years as the bills start to come in.
I wouldn't be surprised if she got a kick.
And it is.
On the first day of competition, there was happier news to report. Gymnast Nadia Comaneci scored a 10 on the uneven bars, the first perfect score awarded in Olympic competition. Richard Pound says that was only the beginning.
It was the games of Comaneci. It was the volleyball semis and finals were probably the finest and most exciting matches ever. We had Sugar Ray Leonard and the Sphinx brothers. I mean, there were a number of fabulous performances. And of course, we had, you know, the doped-up East Germans. And they were special.
When the bills were finally tallied, Montreal would spend $2.3 billion, including interest, to pay for a two-week event that was originally budgeted to cost just $123 million. But those who were close to the games, including Bob Dubois, hold on to this poorly known statistic. Excluding costs for capital projects like the Olympic Stadium, the Montreal Olympic Committee carried a larger budget surplus per capita than the successful Los Angeles Olympics 8 years later.
Unfortunately, people don't know that or don't want to hear that. The only thing they want to hear is how much the Olympic Stadium cost, and it cost a fortune. And it was unfortunate, and I wish that would not have happened. We could have done it in a clearly a less expensive way, but things being what they are, politics being what they are, certain people wanting to have their own Eiffel Tower in Montreal, it just happened.
Most Olympic organizing committees separate costs for stadium, transportation, and road projects from the operating budget for the Games. But in Montreal, the stadium alone cost $1 billion and earned itself a new nickname, according to Sarah McIntyre of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation.
It's affectionately called the Big O, and that's not just the letter, it's the O-W-E for taxpayers. It was originally built to have a retractable dome roof. Again, the design was flawed, the materials were flawed, so it's really turned into a big headache and a big drain for taxpayers.
The operating budget for former Olympic facilities in Montreal runs a $20 million deficit every year. And two engineering studies have concluded that the largely empty stadium, which contains enough concrete to lay a sidewalk from Montreal to Calgary, would cost $500 million to dismantle. Since the Montreal Expos left for Washington in 2004, these doors have been opened most often for tourists. The Olympic Stadium is so rarely used that as this tour goes through in July, the seats are configured for an Alouettes football game that won't happen until October. The sight of an empty stadium weighs on people like CTV sports director Ron Roush.
You know, they always say that the facilities left over is the legacy of the games. Well, the legacy here is practically nothing. For a Montrealer who's been paying for this and my taxes for years, I find it discouraging, and it makes you wonder about the whole Olympic movement and what its value is to any particular city that takes it on.
When the last payment is made on June 30th, the 1976 games might finally fade away as the poster child for Olympic debt, only to be replaced by the 2004 Summer Games in Athens. The latest accounting for that event comes in at a staggering $16 billion and continues to grow as maintenance costs for underused venues adds $124 million a year. Sarah McIntyre says that's a debt the country can't afford.
We've been calling it an Olympic hangover of mythological proportions for Greek taxpayers. And that's a question that needs to be asked time and time again is, when you're shelling out this money for capital projects, is there going to be the demand and use there once the Olympics are gone? If so, then maybe you can make it commercially viable. And if it's made just for that one particular sport, the chances are it's probably going to be a big money loser once the Olympics have actually left.
Some cities have parlayed the Olympics into an economic boon. Infrastructure improvements for the 1992 Games are widely recognized as having taken Barcelona from an industrial backwater to a jewel of Spain. In the decade after the Games, visitors to the city nearly doubled. Richard Pound says it's successes like Barcelona that keep cities bidding.
I mean, you have to ask yourself, if the Olympics are so bad, how is it that we had, you know, in the finals, New York, Moscow, London, Madrid, Paris. We eliminated earlier Rio de Janeiro, Leipzig, Havana, and one other, all wanting the Olympics. Are these people all cosmically stupid or what? Or are they cosmically bright and they understand what can come from it?
Last August, after Montreal had absorbed another $3.2 million of debt to host the World Aquatics Championships, the mayor of Montreal suggested that the city should consider bidding for the 2016 Olympic Games. Reaction to the mayor's proposal was mixed. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Splash Studios in New York and from Carlo Rotella. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to witness the architectural majesty of Montreal's Olympic Stadium, view a gallery of mountain running photographs, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from former Montreal Olympic organizer Bob Dubois, who talks about the 17-cent per pack cigarette tax that's helped repay the enormous debt incurred after the construction of Olympic Stadium.
I'm not a smoker, so it didn't affect me very much, but I guess if I was a smoker, I would be thinking about that every time I took a puff.
Well, I guess it's encouraging that when the last debt payment is made this June, yet another marriage between sports and tobacco will have ended. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public.